IL Women Podcast, the source of her sport.
This is Alyssa Murray Cometti, and I'm doing an intro for this week's podcast because it's a bit different than our past recordings. One of our awesome freelancers, Maggie Cook, and I were able to sit down last week and talk to Mia Hamm. We talked about her career, her interest in lacrosse, and many other things, including the growth of women's team sports over the years. I feel so lucky to have had this conversation and lucky that we are able to share it with you all. The role that Mia and her teammates had on women's team sports is truly transcendent. And since then, so many women's sports have felt the impact since these players have left the field. Here we are, just a few days out from the Women's Final Four in 2022, and there are players that are nationally recognized, and the Division I Women's Lacrosse National Championship game is going to be featured on the ESPN main channel. There has been so much progress in women's sports over the years, and while we still have a long way to go, I feel so grateful for those who have paved the way, including Mia and her teammates. I hope you enjoy the interview, and be sure to keep listening afterwards as Rachel and I break down the Final Four and the Twarton finalists. Enjoy. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a very special edition of the Playing Catch-Up podcast. I still can't believe that I'm saying this, but welcome to the podcast, Mia Hamm.
Thank you. You know, all my lacrosse days. It's so great to be here.
So, as a UNC alum and a fan, what do you think about that UNC lacrosse team this year?
They're a lot of fun to watch. They're incredibly dynamic, athletic. They have so many weapons. But they play hard on both sides of the ball, I think. You know, Jenny has, and the entire staff, has prepared them, but also I think their leadership has been incredibly important in that development. They've been a fun team to really watch grow and compete this year. But lacrosse, you know, women's lacrosse and girls lacrosse is growing so fast. So to see the level where it is today from even 4 or 5 years ago, I'm sure for you that have been a part of the sport for so long is really exciting to see.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. I mean, we played in our alumni game at Syracuse not too long ago, and I'm like, I should hang it up, like never again.
My gosh, truly in the last 4 or 5 years, like the game has just gotten faster, more physical, more exciting. It is so much fun to watch. So when did you become a fan of lacrosse, and what is it about the sport that you enjoy?
Well, I first and foremost, it was when I kind of moved out to the East Coast, where it was part of, you know, every high school, especially the Mid-Atlantic. Mm-hmm. And then going to UNC, we didn't have a women's program at the time, but we had a really good men's program. So going out and watching those guys compete, you know, a lot of them were our friends. Jenny Levy's husband, Dan, and I went to college together, and he's my agent as well. So kind of watching him and his teammates. And I love the speed, the physicality, but also the excitement that the game brings. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as the women's game grew collegiately, just seeing how, you know, most of the time I kept tabs on our program at Carolina and seeing what Jenny's done to kind of develop and grow that program and the history she's made. But just watching, you know, teams from Maryland, Northwestern, Syracuse, and then the list of teams that now are, you know, I live in Los Angeles, just to see USC. You see Stanford, you see Arizona, Arizona State, Colorado, you know, a lot of the Pac-12 schools have adopted women's lacrosse into their athletic departments. So the sport is growing, and, you know, probably the most important thing is I have a daughter that plays and kind of seeing her find joy through the game of lacrosse, mm-hmm. and you know, supporting her in kind of learning more about herself and being challenged on the lacrosse field.
That's awesome. And, you know, just what an icon to look up to as a mom. I mean, my gosh, you've got a lucky daughter.
Well, I mean, you know, she would probably say that I'm just her mom, and that's kind of the way I want it.
Right, of course.
I'm learning more and more about the rules of lacrosse every game I watch. But there are a lot of similarities in terms of angles and movements and, you know, defensively kind of the pressure cover and the fitness base is very similar.
Right.
So mm-hmm. attack and defense is a lot of kind of short sprints and being agile and quick. And then midfielders need to basically run for days. And that's but also be good on both sides of the ball. So it's a lot of similarities from soccer in that way.
What position does your daughter play?
She's a middie.
Yeah,
she's got pretty good speed. So I think that helps her in her transition. But, you know, it's been a lot of fun to kind of see her find her own way. And I think this is mm-hmm. this is for her just something that she's really embraced. And as her parents, you know, we love seeing her kind of understand the importance of investing and seeing the reward when she does. And, you know, she's still young. She just turned 15. So and here on the West Coast, it's not as kind of established as I know lacrosse is on the East Coast. So, you know, we're going to spend a lot of our summer months probably on the East Coast going to tournaments.
Oh man, you're in the club. You're speaking our language now.
Relax, mom.
Maggie runs a club or helps run a club program. That's what I was doing prior to taking the job at IL this winter. And so the club lacrosse circuit is just like speaking our language for sure. And it's, you know, it's a necessary yes. evil to kind of like play the best and to get better. And, you know, it's so fun. And want to quickly just take it back to Carolina and kind of talk about, you know, how dominant, I mean, there's starting a dynasty on the women's lacrosse side, but women's soccer has been established for such a long time. And I was wondering if you could kind of talk a little bit about that program and, you know, what is it that makes it so good? And is it something that can be recreated elsewhere at another program? Like, is it something about North Carolina or is it something about Anson, Dorrance, or, you know, you tell us.
I think it can be recreated. The problem to do that is everyone has to be invested. At least the majority have to be invested every single day. And I would say that's one of the things that set us apart early. You know, we had a lot of support. You know, it's the year, the 50th anniversary of Title IX, but Title IX helped, you know, UNC women's soccer with our scholarship allocation early. Mm-hmm. But more so, it was about the culture that Anson and longtime assistant Bill Palladino created. And it was one of accountability, individual development, the importance of a strong team dynamic, and bringing us an understanding how you elevated each other every single day in practice. Because in the end, that's who you compete against 99% of the time, were your teammates. And did you show up every day at practice to make each other better? And to do that, you know, all of us say we do, but you know, there are moments that we weren't there. And I know I had bad days of training, but majority of the team showed up to being better every single day. And I think that accountability was incredibly important in developing our team culture. But also the standpoint of being there for one another, like you do it out of love and support. It's not this kind of ideal of, I don't care about anyone else. I'm just going to play as hard as I can. It's like, no, I care about you. So I show up. This goes beyond what happens on the field and the wins and losses. Like I'm committed to being the best teammate and the best friend I can be, regardless of what happens. And so I think for me, that intensity was apparent every single day in training. And then when we got to the game days, it was just all about free expression and kind of celebrating all that hard work and that sense of unity and team that, pushed us during that week of practice. And, one of the things that Anson would say to us before we would walk onto the field of every game, he's like, I love team sports because there's going to be moments in games where I'm not playing well and you're going to carry me. You know, your teammates are going to carry mm-hmm. you and vice versa. They're going to be instances in games where they're not playing well and it's your job to carry them. So it was about accountability, responsibility, but just investment in each other and the power that brings to the unit when you're committed. And you have to affirm that every single day. Like it can't just be one season. It's like, yay, we're a team. This is great. We love right. being here. But you have to mm-hmm. do it every single day. And that, for a lot of people, that's difficult. It just, they don't, I think at the beginning of a season, they wouldn't say it is, but it is. And especially when yeah. things are difficult, it's like, what is going on? What am I doing here? Like, I'm not enjoying this. Mm-hmm. But you have yep. to believe your value is worth it. And obviously your teammates are worth that investment.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just sitting here like smiling. It just seems that sounds exactly like someone that I would enjoy playing for, that anyone would enjoy playing for. And, you know, just the investment in each other, it's just that dynamic that is so special. And, kind of want to, you talk about UNC, but then you also, it seems like based off of what I know and what I've followed mostly on the national team is you guys had that similar mentality and just like yeah. team bond. And, you know, it's exactly what I love so much about team sports is that, you know, they're your best friends, you play for each other. And, you know, I think that's part of what made the national team coming up so contagious. And so everyone wanted to be a part of it. And so what I'm curious is, like, as a member on that team, when did you guys start to feel like, okay, this is becoming something? We are, you know, there's a shift of like the attention and fandom. Where, you know, did you realize that you were having that much of an impact on women's sports at the time?
I think the 96 Olympics enabled us to grow our fan base outside of the soccer community. Because of, you know, I don't know if you know how Olympic ticket packages work, but it's like, if you want to go to track and field, yeah.
Right.
If you want to go to the track and field 100 meter final, they're like, well, you have to buy this sport too,
right.
To get the premium seating. So, you know, a lot of what we heard and saw afterwards, after the 96 Olympics, were like, you know, we weren't even anticipating going to women's soccer, but it was by far the best event we went to. And we're like, all right, that's great. Like,
take what we can get.
Yeah. And so I think it Love introduced that. Us and grew our fan base. And so I think that when we were in the process of selling the 99 World Cup and going around to all the cities that were going to host games, we had a lot more kind of eyes and ears to do it because of what the 96 Olympics did for us. And, you know, the fact that the Olympics were in Atlanta, I think on the same time zone, enabled us to do that. And so we just built on that momentum in 99. And then, you know, the timing was perfect. When our tournament was, there wasn't a lot going on. We weren't competing for kind of eyes and people's time. It was bigger than I think we all imagined. You know, we had hoped that it would explode the way it did, but, you know, it was just a lot of investment by a lot of people to make it happen. And, you know, it was just, we weren't ready for kind of the tsunami that was post 99, but at the same time, looking back, just seeing all the doors that it opened for so many in so many different sports. It wasn't just women's soccer. I think you saw kind of a culture shift in the investment in women's sports, especially women's team sports. And, you know, I think what you're seeing today across the country, you know, and girls and women's lacrosse is a testament to that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Well, when you said the tsunami that was coming, I mean, I still remember where I was watching that game when you guys won the World Cup. Like, it is a memory I have that I will never forget, and my peers will never forget. Like, we were all glued to our TVs that summer. We didn't want to do anything but watch that national team play. And, you know, for speaking for myself as a female athlete, a young female athlete at that time, you know, it was incredible to see you and your teammates. And for us, in an age before social media, you were it. You were the role model. Like, we were fighting over number 9 on my soccer team because we all wanted to be Mia Hamm when we got out there. So you essentially became a forced role model in a way. And you were one of the few female athletes that had this platform that we were looking up to. Like, how did you deal with that pressure? Of course, you know, everyone knew who you were, but then after that World Cup, I imagine life really kind of got crazy.
Yeah, it did. I think, you know, I first and foremost, I'm the fourth out of 6 kids. So my entire life, I've kind of lived in relative obscurity. I just kind of did my thing and then, you know, competing in sports was just where I really found myself and felt I had, you know, that's where my passion was. And then after 99, I think everyone looks for a person, a player to kind of help carry the game forward. And it was hard. I'm not going to deny that it was hard because for a lot of reasons. One, that just wasn't my personality. You know, I was quiet as a kid. I'm still quiet now, pretty introspective. but I also knew it was a great opportunity to talk about what makes our game so great and what makes our team so strong. And to be able to highlight and thank my teammates in public ways meant so much to me because, you know, as we talked earlier about the culture of Carolina and the national team, those are the players that made me who I was. You know, first and foremost, our leadership created an environment for us to be ourselves. You know, we didn't, thank God, not everyone was like me. You know, it would be pretty boring. But to celebrate kind of our differences and our individuality. And, you know, we weren't micromanaged in any way. And so to be able to kind of stand in front of people and talk about what makes us great, even though, you know, you always had people, they were like, yeah, whatever. You guys don't get along. And I'm like, yeah, we do. Like, do we yell at each other on the field? Yeah. Like all the time, because we're competitors.
Right.
I was like, but there's no one else I'd want on the field than my teammates next to me. Like, I just trust them with everything, you know. And we talk about how they've seen your greatest victories and the times in practice where you failed or you quit on fitness, and they're still there to kind of pull you up and saying, all right, it was a bad day and we're going to be better tomorrow. Mm-hmm. So the opportunity to kind of talk about that, but to help grow the game, you know, I was all in with doing. I think the personal focus was fine. I mean, I think for me, it was so important to share with young girls that, you know, that we were more alike than we were different. I think a lot of the times they just assume, mm-hmm. like, oh, you had the best training environment. So I'm like, no, I played on crap fields, with like clumps of grass in the middle of North Texas. Mm-hmm. If I wanted a pair of new cleats, I had to pay half. So I had to figure out how to, make the money to do that. A lot of the times growing up, I got myself to practice like these, and I wasn't on all these huge club teams. I basically played on co-ed teams and played on my local teams. But the thing I did every single day I got to play was I wanted to win. I wanted to compete. I wanted to be better mm-hmm. than whoever I was faced up against. And that helped me improve. You know, I was lucky to have an older brother who kind of let me hang out with him. So I was constantly playing up against, you know, he and his buddies. So I think to share those stories with kind of the younger girls watching was important. Because, you know, when I travel, a lot of the times the questions I get are from younger girls, or younger kids, is like, what's your favorite food? What's your favorite color? Because like, if all of a sudden you say what they like, they're like, oh my God, you know, you just see they have that connection.
Right.
And then some
I
of
like
the older,
blue too.
Yeah. Some of the old Carolina blue, some of the older, the older kids, it's like, how do you deal with failure? How do you deal with disappointment? Did you ever get nervous before games? I'm like, oh my God, all the time. I was the player that no one wanted to really sit next to because I didn't talk. Like, I just was kind of in my own zone. And, you know, so to be able to kind of share those experiences with young people and young players, to say that, you know, to let them know that it wasn't easy and that we're not as different as people, as you might think we are.
Yeah, I mean, that says it all, honestly. I think, like, you know, it's funny to just like hear you say that, because as we were talking, getting ready for this podcast, we were kind of mentioning the same thing, as like, you are an athlete, you're just, you know, better than us, but like, just but like, just like us, like, you probably enjoy the same things, you love the team, the locker room, like that sort of thing. And it's just like, thinking about the younger generation and all that, you know, mental health is just such a hot topic right now, with good reason, of like the pressure that these players and young kids put on themselves in so many different ways, that like, having someone like you being able to say like, it's okay to feel those feelings. I felt the same way, is probably just such a huge thing for them to be able to be like, I'm not alone in these feelings.
And mm-hmm. so it brings me to, did you have anyone, you know, when you're saying you didn't speak on the bus or the locker room, was there anyone that, and granted, it's not like it is today with social media and all of that, but was yeah. there someone that you were able to look up to that was, you know, forging a path in women's athletics prior to you? Or was there anyone that comes to mind, honestly?
Well, I had, you know, I still do, but I watched a lot of sports growing up, like any opportunity yeah. to kind of see someone compete. But obviously the chances of seeing a female athlete on TV were more isolated to kind of women's tennis. And so mm-hmm. I remember watching Chris Everett play, and you know, the Olympics were huge for me, and seeing Jackie Joyner-Kersee, and mm-hmm. you know, I remember watching Nadia Comaneci, and then watching, you know, the Men's World Cup. Those were some of my earliest memories of soccer, and a lot of the times they were I saw them on Spanish speaking television. So I kind of had to make up my own play-by-play of what was happening in my head, not aloud. I think my siblings would have thrown me out of the room. But just you know, it was what's really wonderful now for our kids is to be able to turn on TV on the TV and for them to see, you know, athletes that look like them, and on so many different networks, you mm-hmm. know, I whether it's women's basketball or soccer or, you know, softball or lacrosse, you know, it's wonderful to see how much things have changed.
I have mm-hmm. a 1.5-year-old daughter, and we're supposed to not, you know, they say don't give screen time until 2 years old at this point, but I'm like, you know, women's sports don't count. Watch all the, like, I have pictures of her watching the ACC, like, plopped in front of the TV. I'm like, watch all you want, girl.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so on the coaching front, was there a specific coach that you've had who has had a profound impact on your career, not just specifically coaching wise, but helping you navigate through the attention and the pressure and all of that? Is there someone or some people you may name?
I learned a lot from Anton, obviously, how to compete, but also how to express myself. I think he's an incredible motivator. He's very mindful of bringing everyone in. Like when you mm-hmm. Ever watch him speak, he'll come into a room and, you know, obviously he's thought about his remarks, but he's really wonderful about being able to connect with those that he either just meets or, you know, he didn't know they were coming, being a part of the game or the program, and just how important that is to say thank you publicly to people, to acknowledge their investment in the game and investment into, you know, him as a person. So I learned the importance of that. I learned from Tony DiCicco so much about mm-hmm. Finding strength through vulnerability. And I think he was just someone who was very real and secure in who he was. And that mm-hmm. transferred so much to us as players. He was not, I mean, Anson and Antoni were not micromanagers. They trusted us. And he helped me understand that I didn't have to be the best in everything I did. because he said he wasn't. And I think for a coach to stand up in front of his players and say, I know I'm not good at this aspect of coaching, so I'm going to make sure that I'm covered by the assistants I bring in or our mental skills coach, said so much to us as players about you know, focusing on our strengths and what makes us great. And so it allowed us to make mistakes and learn to grow from them, and to be able to turn to your teammates and say, listen, I need help. Like I'm not good at this, or I need to be fitter. Can you help me? Mm-hmm. So when you have a coach that leads that way, it makes you more willing to kind of put yourself out there. And that's how you become your best, is you're willing to kind of risk it and to see what happens.
Mm-hmm. That's something we talked about at Syracuse, was just, you know, our coach Gary was, you know, everything's contagious. And so, you know, the energy you're putting out there is what you want to be spread throughout the team. And that's something I've taken as a coach. When I was coaching down in Austin, when you talk about Tony, he was the head coach of the 96 Olympics, which was the first of women's soccer in the Olympics. I'm not sure, you may have heard, but LA in 2028 is looking pretty good for lacrosse to be included, hopefully. As you know, someone who was in the Olympics for the first time in your respective sport, what happens? Like, what can you say would happen to the lacrosse sport? Will you tell us the future? What do you think the inclusion of lacrosse could do for the sport?
Well, so I don't know if you have the same experiences with lacrosse, but I remember, you know, the first time being on the national team. And from 91, you know, we won the World Cup in 91, but from 91 to 95, basically, we would travel around the country. And a lot of the times people would see us in airports because we're all wearing the same kind of tracksuit, sweatsuit. And they'd come up and be like, are you on a team? Be like, yeah. So who do you play for? We play for the U.S. national team. Is that a college? Is that like the university?
Stop.
We're like, no, it's the best players from all over the United States. Oh, wow. But when we could say we were the Olympic team, people were like, oh, my God, that's amazing. Like it just changed the conversation. And so I think for, you know, lacrosse, it'll probably do the same thing. You'd be like, I play on Team USA. Oh, really? What country is that? No, well, it's the United States.
People be like, oh, she's on the Olympics. I'm like, I wish I could say that, but like, that's literally a lie. Like, it's not.
But I think, you know, when they talk about Team USA, they automatically jump to the Olympics. And then what's really kind of crazy is they just assume you're a part of it. You're like, no, you know, we're working on it. I think it just opens doors for so many more people. And as I said, a whole new fan base that just is so into the Olympic Games, and who, you know, every 4 years, every 2 years, summer and winter, can kind of turn it on and be like, I am all Team USA all day. And so now they're able to kind of watch, you know, lacrosse in the Olympics. Well, I know it'll change the game, and it'll change all these players' lives. I mean, the Olympics is just, it's just awesome. Like, everything about it. We talk about, like, our favorite time being in the Olympic Village is you just go to the cafeteria and you just sit and people watch. Like,
I bet.
It's like you see the basketball player with the gymnast walking to the table, and one's like 7 feet tall and the other one's like 4 or 5. And but they're the best at what they do, and you're like,
right,
holy cow, this is so awesome.
All different walks of life. My gosh.
Yeah.
That sounds amazing. All right. So let's, one last question here before we go to our quick fast five questions. So very exciting news was made public today regarding the U.S. soccer's equal pay agreement. Do you have any thoughts on this? I mean, this is tremendous for the sport, tremendous for the women's national team. And, you know, people have been fighting for this for a very long time. Like, what does this mean for women's soccer and for U.S. soccer as a collective?
Well, first, I just want to say thank you to the players and everyone that was working on their behalf. It wasn't easy to get to where they are today. It took a lot of courage and strength and just a collective commitment to seeing this out, because I am sure there were days where it got really scary, but they knew they were doing it for the right reasons. And it's not just the impact on women's sports and the national team, but across the board, how women walk into their employer's, you know, office and talk about what they should be paid. And I'm incredibly proud of Cindy Parlow-Cohn, who's a former teammate of mine and the president of U.S. Soccer. This was paramount for her to get this done, to make a statement. You know, the U.S. Women's National Team, U.S. Soccer Federation has always been a leader, a pioneer in women's sports. And I know there are a lot of other federations that talk about equal pay. And to some degree, it was kind of it, but this is equal across the board. And I also want to say thank you to the men's national team and their players association, because they saw the importance of fighting together. And, you know, what I'm hoping is this just kind of sends shockwaves, across the country, but across the world in terms of how important it is to commit to the women's side of sports and to women in general. And you've seen the investment or the return on investment of what happens, and just excited for the future for this team, but also how we can continue to kind of break the glass ceiling of what's in front of us.
It's unbelievable. And it's, you know, like you said, it's going to affect more than just soccer. I think to be able to set that example again, you know, you guys said it, getting yourselves on the map and then, you know, to fight for equal pay. It's unbelievable. But okay, fast five, really quick questions to wrap it up. Pressure's on. If you were a lacrosse player, what position would you play?
Oh, I'd be attack, no doubt. Like I wasn't a midfielder because I didn't have the like body type or fitness base. Like I'm a sprinter and a walker. So
I can relate.
And I like scoring goals.
I can relate.
Of course.
All right. Pre-game for you. Was there a specific artist, a specific song that you would always listen to?
No. a lot of the times my music was probably a little bit slower and, but I always love, like, we had a couple teammates like Tiffany Roberts and Danielle Fotopoulos would put on their like, pump up music. So one, I always felt younger when they, if I knew the words to the song, but, you know, it got me out of my comfort zone a little less, kind of into myself and my own, call it your IPZ, individual performance zone, and just, you know, let me have some fun.
All right. Okay. Next one. What's your favorite activity outside of sports?
Golf.
Well, that's a sport, but
are you a good golfer?
outside of sport. Sorry.
But golf is a good hobby.
Yeah, let me. I would say cooking, favorite activity outside of cooking.
Okay.
Yeah, outside
what's your
of sports
best meal? Would be cooking. Okay.
What's my best meal? That's a great question. I do a pretty good roast chicken. I do a pretty good risotto. I do
love a good risotto.
Good red sauce, which takes a little bit of time. Yeah, my, okay. I think my kids would say I'm pretty good. I hope.
All right. What's one thing you can't live without?
Wine. I can't live without wine. It's carbohydrates.
Hey, back to your point, we're more alike than we are different.
Like, if we stay on the food, it would be chips and salsa. Like, I could... I could walk by a table with pretty much anything on it, but if chips and salsa, and I could have just had a huge meal, but if chips and salsa were on the table, it'd be really hard for me to.
There's always more room for some carbs.
Yeah.
There's never a limit.
That's how they work too.
Yeah, exactly. Make room. You burn them quick so you can eat more.
Yep.
Well, thank you so much. We can't thank you enough for all of the time that you took to talk to us. And, you know, I'm sure that people listening will be so grateful to hearing all that you have to say about women's sports. And we are just so grateful. So
thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a Catching Up podcast for those of you who have stayed on through the double episode. I'm here with Rachel DiCecco. Hallie is out sick, and so it's the two of us previewing the Final Four, only a few days away from the 2022 champion being crowned. We already had the D2 champions of UIndy being crowned yesterday, and we're here to talk about the Division One and all things D1 today. Rachel, how's it going?
Great. It's going well. I'm excited about this weekend's games.
You finished up your season of coaching your daughters. How was that?
So fun. That's honestly the best age to coach, the 1, 2, 7, 8-year-olds, because they really can't do much with the skills of lacrosse, but they're just so happy to be there and having so much fun. And like, I will play Hungry Hippos all day long, so I'm happy. they had a good time. I mean, they were like catching passes by the end of the season, so you get to see like a really like steep curve at that age when they just sort of like light bulb goes off. So I love coaching that age group, and the parents are pretty chill at that age, so it's good too.
That's the key.
Yeah, I mean, that's not true for much longer, so I'm happy to stay in that age group.
I'm sure there's a shift that happens in just a couple of years. I was just saying how to one of my friends, I'm like, I'll coach like the third grade team that with no expectations or pressure at this point in my life. So that's what I'm all about. Third grade lacks or younger. But yeah, I think there'll be a little jump in skills from watching your past weekend to the Final Four. North Carolina will play Northwestern first. I believe the game's at 3:00. And, you know, North Carolina had a little scare in the quarterfinals, just like last year. It's now the semifinals, and Northwestern's going to try and stun them again. And I thought Northwestern looked awesome this past weekend, or this past Thursday. But to me, I just think North Carolina is on a mission. What do you think about that game?
Yeah, I think Stony Brook played them really close, as like you said, as they did last year. And that was the worst thing that could happen for Northwestern, because I don't think North Carolina will have two games where they sort of allow that to happen. So it is North Carolina's championship to win or lose. They are, I would say, the favorite. They're just so talented and have such a complete team. But I got to watch the Northwestern Syracuse game live, and that was the third Northwestern game I've done this season, and I have not seen them play like that. Madison just sat over 70% save percentage.
defensively, Ali Palermo was incredible. And we didn't mention that, you know, you didn't think a lot about the defense because they were just playing so well. So, like, there wasn't anything to say. They were just so solidly strong. And then, you know, Girardi / Dwyer was in the draw there against Mischewski. So I think having both of those tools against Mastroianni is going to be huge. And then offensively, they just they had 9 different scorers. So it sort of sounded like we've been describing North Carolina all year. So they were so well prepped and so they were just ready for what Syracuse threw at them, and they executed perfectly. And that's what it'll take, I think, to beat North Carolina. So I, you know, before this weekend, I was like, North Carolina, Northwestern is not playing their best lacrosse. You know, they lost to Rutgers. They got really beat up by Maryland, and they like eked by Michigan, a good Michigan team. But like after watching them Thursday, I sort of flipped the script, and I think they're going to give North Carolina like a really good game.
And that's what you hope for in the semifinals. It's like you want every game from here on out. I mean, you want it all season long, but especially in the Final Four, you want the best teams to make it to the semifinals. And I think, you know, this reflection of top 4 seeds making it is exactly that. You know, we can dive more into the order of the seedings and all of that another day. But with how the seedings were set, the fact that 1, 2, 3, and 4 are the ones that advance is pretty clear that the best 4 teams, or what the selection committee deemed as the best 4 teams, are the ones that made it through. And I agree. I think Northwestern looked unbelievably complete. And I don't think, you know, even watching them play Michigan in the second round, they were so hot and cold. Like, they let these long runs go. And I think having the alternate options on the draw against Mastroianni will be helpful. Again, obviously North Carolina has like 2, 3, 4 options on the draw, but none of those players are the second leading draw control per game player like Girardi is. And I think she's just so good. And to have an option like Dwyer, who is a fifth year and so experienced, that's going to play in their favor. And they did lose the draw control battle to Syracuse. It was about the only thing they lost in that game, but they made up for it in so many different areas. Like, you know, they ground balls and just midfield type plays that may not even show up in the stat sheet. I think their mentality of gritty and like play hard, it's like very similar to Stony Brook. Like, they both teams like have such like grit mentalities. And so I think anytime you're going to play, like, I'm sure Carolina's talking about this, getting ready to play the second straight gritty team like that. It's like anytime you're playing a team like that, you're preparing for a full game. Like, you can't drop off at any point in the game to let them sneak back in or let them get a lead or anything like that. Because, you know, when you're playing like that, you have such emotion behind your game. But again, I do think North Carolina is going to run away with it. I think someone that doesn't get talked about enough for me is Scotty Rose Grownie. Like, I feel like she has been the second half of the season one of the best attackers for Carolina. And just like, you know, I Aldave does an unbelievable job on the inside getting open, and she's good for like a hat trick a game, I feel like. But Scotty Rose Grownie, even going back to the Notre Dame near loss, she won that game for them.
Yeah, I totally agree. Watching ACCs, to me, she is so underrated. And it's hard to get, like, when you talk about North Carolina, to like not forget somebody that's so incredible. But I feel like Scotty Rose Grownie is so talented. And she creates so much for them. And she's so strong and powerful that people have to, you know, you've got to slide to her. And even then, she'll split the double team. So I think like the attention that she pulls, even if she's not going to score, is just so key for them, knowing how many other weapons that they have that they can go to. But I 100% agree. Like, she is so underrated. And you talked about the mentality, and in talking to Kelly Amani before their game against Syracuse, she described them as unburdened, and that is exactly how they played. Like, they had nothing to lose. They were just there to have fun. And like, you've been there. Like, Final Four is almost more mental than it is physical. Like, how you approach those games in terms of pressure and like, you know, feeling like anything less than a championship is a failure. Like, and that's how Northwestern, you know, Martin Gilbert were saying that's sort of how they used to operate. Like, if we'd win the championship, the season was a failure. And now they're like, actually, no, we're going to take each game as it comes and appreciate the moments. And I feel like from that standpoint, North Carolina is at a disadvantage because everybody has put all of the pressure on them to win, us included, right? You know,
right.
And Jenny does a great job from a mentality standpoint of not getting them caught up in that, but it's got to be in the back of their mind. Everybody expects you to win. Anything less will be like, how did this happen again? And that's really hard, I think, to block out that noise as an athlete. So, you know, I think on the opposite end, Northwestern is playing like they got nothing to lose. No one expects them to win the championship except for maybe them. So that's interesting from a matchup mentality standpoint for me.
For sure. And something that reminds me of is Katrina Dowd was our assistant coach when we were sophomores, and we made it to the national championship after not making the playoffs my freshman year. So it was like a total reverse season my sophomore year. And something she mentioned, just talking about mentality, was like when she was at Northwestern, it was like in Northwestern's heyday of dynasty time. And she's like, you know, over half the time, we had won the game before we even set foot on the field because just of the way that teams were walking into games. And that even included the Final Four, because you look at, if you go back to the scores back then, it's like the semifinal game was a blowout. They even blew out, I want to say, and now this is really going back, I want to say they even blew out North Carolina in the national championship back in like 08 or 09. And that's just like, I mean, granted, they were so, so, so skilled. So not taking away from that, but like pair that with just like unbelievable mentality. And, you know, that has to come from a coach like Kelly Amonte, you know, that she's preaching that type of toughness and that type of mental toughness. But I agree, you know, North Carolina has such a target on their back, and to be able to keep it fun and light, like Jenny has aimed to do, it's like you look on the sideline and those girls are having fun. And you have to do that when you have all the pressure. You have to be able to enjoy every game and every moment and not let your mind race to the finish line, which may have been a little bit of what they did last year, and it caught up to them. So, you know, obviously they have some freshmen, but most players felt that crushing loss, and to feel that and now have the opportunity to learn from it, I don't think that they're going to let that moment escape them. Let's talk about another storied program that has had a very reverse year. Maryland. And, you know, we talked about it last week. And again, like, what a freaking game for Maryland against Florida. They just look so good. Obviously, Boston, you can't ever count Boston College out, because I just think Charlotte North turns it on, brings it to another level. Their defense is underrated. I don't think we talk about how good their defense is one-on-one. But man, I think that Maryland Boston College is going to be a tough, tough matchup.
I totally agree with you. Maryland is playing such good lacrosse right now across the board, starting with Emily Sterling, who's at like a 56% save percentage. And you know, you've got Cordingley, and we're going to talk about Tuart in finals. So Cordingley, Clevenger, Lou Becker, Libby May. I mean, they have such talent, and then Bosco defensively. Maryland is a force right now, and BC is going to have to play, you know, their D. I agree. Again, their D is super strong. Charlotte North, like, this is, you know, it's like the Michael Jordan flu game. Like, somebody like that level of player, like, is going to just do insane, amazing things, because that's who they are. Like, that's their moment. That's when they show up. And I feel like Charlotte North is that kind of player that's going to show up huge in championship weekend. But will it be enough? I don't know. Rachel Hall had a tough day against Loyola, like, and it's going to be about, obviously they're going to get shots off, but Maryland, so it's like giving them the shots that they don't want to take is going to be the key, because they're going to have to play well across the board, because Maryland is playing so, so well and so cohesive as a team right now.
Yeah, and I think if you look back to the ACC championship, you know, Bell Smith had low numbers, Jen Medjid, I believe, had low numbers. And so they're going to need to step up a little bit. Charlotte's going to score. I'm actually really interested about that matchup. And I'm curious to see if Bosco will guard North. And I'm interested in it just because, I think Bosco's unbelievable. Like, she eliminated Lauren Gilbert.
TT Neslonsky, yep.
Yeah, she's eliminated them. But the one thing that I'm curious about is, I don't know that Charlotte and Bosco match up well, because Charlotte is so strong and Bosco's a little more petite, and she eliminates people based off of how quick her footwork is. But I feel like Charlotte might be able to just overpower someone, where Trenchard matches up pretty well with Charlotte because she's got a little bit more strength behind her. So I'm just curious about that. I could be totally wrong. I don't even have a guess of how it would go, but it is something that if I'm Maryland, I'm talking about, we're going to have Abby on Charlotte, but we have to be ready to have a quick slide, because what you can do at least is have Bosco force her one way. So at least you know where she's going to be sending her every time. And you can pretty confidently say that she would be able to do that. But it's just is she going to be out-muscled going to the cage? I don't know. You're the defensive brain.
No, so. I think it's a great flag. The other thing is Maryland plays really physical defense, and depending on the official unit, you don't want to put Charlotte on the hash. She loves that, the hash, right? I'm talking about, right? To me, that is going to be a challenge for Maryland, if depending on who, how they're calling it, if they're letting them play or they're calling it more closely, that could quickly be, problematic for the Maryland defense. Yeah. I mean, Charlotte, it's a great call. I just who do you, yeah. I mean, then you use Bosco, if you use Bosco on Charlotte, then who's your help? And then you've got Medjid and Mossman and Belle Smith. Maybe you put Bosco on Belle Smith, cause she's so incredibly talented. And when you have somebody like Charlotte North on your team, and this is not Charlotte's doing, this is our doing, the supporting cast, they're so good, but they just don't get talked about as much because of Charlotte. But Belle Smith is just a sophomore, and I think one of the best players in the country.
Yeah, and she's, a lot of people were talking about how quiet she was earlier in the season, but she's come on. I feel like it started in, and it may have started earlier than this, but she was hello, I'm here, in the Boston College loss to Duke, when almost everything was going wrong for Boston College in that game. They just couldn't pull it together. But the most promising thing was that Belle Smith had just an unbelievable day. She was involved in virtually every single play, every single score. But yeah, I don't know. It should be really interesting. And I think that you look at the Boston College losses, it's been against goalies that have had great days against them. So, as wonderful shooters as they are, they're going to need to really be intentional with where they're putting the ball, because Emily Sterling is having an unbelievable year. The one thing that Boston College has in their favor, or maybe not the one thing, but one of the things, is their experience in the Final Four. There's only one, I forget, one player that has Final Four experience on this team. I think Grace Griffin, or very few, if one starter maybe. I remember Kathy Reese saying that, or they were talking about it in the broadcast, that they were cheering for the regular season Big Ten championship. And Kathy's like, what do you mean? We're Maryland. This is what we do. This isn't but then she had the thought, oh my gosh, Libby May hasn't experienced this success. And that's one of their best players, Hannah Lubecker, all of these players that are, their top go-to girls don't have experience in these big moments. And so where Boston College does, they've been there before. And, I think, regardless, they have so much veteran leadership that it probably won't really affect them outside of maybe the first quarter or even first 10 minutes. But as long as they can ride that moment of oh my gosh, we're in the Final Four, then I think they'll be in good shape. But I can't even pick who I think is going to win because I think it's going to be such a good game.
I do too. I do too. I think it's going to be a really good game. And then any combination of the championship is so exciting to me. Like any, you know, any of those combos, it's exactly what you want championship weekend, you know, just incredible talent. And I was looking at, like, sort of reading some stuff before we did this, and I look at the coaches, the four head coaches who were all incredible players, you know, when they, in their time, and now just these legacy coaches. I just think it's just an incredible bunch of leaders in the sport. And then obviously all the athletes. So I'm super, super excited to see it all happen. It
should be awesome. And on TV, even better.
I mean, ESPN Maine, I think back to just 2 years ago when almost everything was on Plus and they were all at the same time. And it just felt like it was an afterthought. And then you fast forward to this year and all the quarters are televised on ESPNU, you know, not at the same time. And the championship game is on ESPN Maine. That's just never happened. So yeah. It's so exciting. And I can't wait to watch.
Before we move on, just quickly, I'm interested in your thoughts. There were some complaints, and I don't know what the solution is to this, because I understand. I'm curious to see what people thought about the quarterfinals being on Thursday, because it is a quick turnaround from the second round. But also, if you make it to Final Four, it's really nice to be able to have that much time to prepare and recover, because by then your body hurts. And I'm curious to see what people thought about the Thursday game, and also how it went for TV, you know, viewership and all of that. Because, you know, obviously the games were during some times where the kids were in school, but I mean, I loved it. I loved that was Thursday. It wasn't overshadowed by men's games. It was specifically women's lacrosse. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I liked it too on Thursday, because I do think it gave it its own platform. Like, had it happened on the weekend of the men's, you know, it could have been, like you said, potentially overshadowed, or the time of the games could have been not ideal, just because that's, you know, that's how it would have to go. But, and I mean, people are at school and work, but on the weekends, like, it's harder for me almost to watch games on the weekends if your kids are playing or you're coaching. So I think it's sort of half six one way, half dozen another. I'm interested to see the ratings, but I mean, there was so much conversation around the games. It really felt like a lot of folks were tuned in. So either, you know, I think it was a success, but I'm also interested to see the numbers.
Yeah, it should. I mean, it'll be an interesting conversation to have, but I personally enjoyed it. And maybe I just liked, you know, having some time to let it all simmer before the Final Four.
Yeah.
All right, let's go to Wharton finalists. Let's go through them real quick and just talk about their strength and if we think they have a chance of winning the whole thing. Let's start with Megan Tyrell, because she is the only one that won't be in the Final Four. I mean, my Cuse girl, I think she's unbelievable, but I think it's fair to say that she's probably out of the running at this point, just not being in the Final Four. But that said, certainly All-American, certainly, you know, hopefully she comes back next year. I would think that she would be, all of these players would be out of the running. And I think she would be, if she comes back, a finalist or favorite even.
Yeah, I mean, she has more points than any of the other finalists when you look at it. And potentially has had more impact on her team than anybody other than maybe Charlotte. But yeah, I think it's fair to say, you know, it depends on, it's always a conversation we have. Is the Tuartan sort of, how much impact does what your team does have on you winning versus like your impact, you know, your influence on your team and your influence in the game. But Tyrell's influence on her team is, you know, top two, three in the country, but yet not making the Final Four, I do think probably puts her out of contention to win that award.
Agreed. All right. Then next, let's go to the defending winner, Charlotte North, where, you know, I think that even with Boston College, not necessarily, if at this point, we don't know if they're going to win or lose. I think that she would still be in the running, you know, breaking a million records. I feel like I can't even list them all because I'll forget one. I think she's still in the running, win or lose. Especially if she has like a big performance in the semifinals, win or loss. Like if she has a big day, then for me, I think that she's at least in the conversation, not necessarily winning again, but in the conversation.
I totally agree. I think she's probably the one player that could still win if her team doesn't win the championship. She won last year. She set the all-time goals record in NCAA. And she's Charlotte North. So she has changed, arguably changed the game more than anybody in this generation, potentially. So it depends on how the committee's thinking about, like, who should win the award. Is it this season? Is it the body of work as in a career? Is it, you know, how your team does? So I agree. Like, I think if they were to win, if they are to lose Friday, it would be tough. But like you said, if she throws up four or five goals, you know, she's still very much in the running to win.
Agreed. And okay, so next up, Ally Mastriani. And this is an interesting one because obviously she's technically competing against, I guess we can talk about him around the same time, Jamie Ortega. And I don't see it going to Mastriani over Ortega at any point. And as great as Mastriani is, but I think if a Carolina player is going to win it, it's going to be Ortega. You know, the career points record holder at Carolina, ACC record holder over 400 points, you know, you name it. She's done it at Carolina.
If somebody from North Carolina wins it, it will be Ortega for sure. I think it's, you know, not to take anything away from Mastriani because I think she's incredible and North Carolina has been on a run. But if I'm Northwestern, I'm like, where's Lauren Gilbert in this final five? Like, you know, and it's not necessarily fair to not have two from the same team if they're two of the best players in the country, but I feel like Gilbert belongs in there somewhere. And I think Ortega is probably a little bit more of the favorite than Charlotte right this second, based on how UNC's playing. But if UNC were to lose on Friday, I think that makes things really interesting for the Tarleton race because I think they need to win. And I don't know whether this is fair or not, but I think they need to win potentially for Jamie to win.
I do too. And so just quickly, this is how I feel about the finalists. And like, I think it's, like you said, if there's a Carolina player winning it, that's Ortega. And I think unless Ortega just did nothing this year, that was how it would have been all year long. And so as it's a huge honor to be named a finalist regardless. So like, I understand the desire to recognize Mastriani for that. But like, if we knew that she had no chance essentially, and maybe we could be totally wrong. We're just guessing. But if Mastriani wasn't a legitimate chance to be holding the trophy at the end of the ceremony, then why not give that to Gilbert? Because she's clearly had a great year. They're in the final four. What if Gilbert just has this unbelievable and leads Northwestern to a champion? If we could have chosen after the fact, then, you know, you would probably say she deserves it if they end up going far or whatever, but she's not even an option. So I don't know. I think that's interesting.
Yeah, I do too. I think, Gilbert certainly deserves to be in there, but the Mastriani, because, and this is the challenge with North Carolina, because they're so good. Like you put Mastriani on any other team and you're like, oh gosh, she's the best player on the team, but it's just, she's
right.
And like, we talked about Scotty was grounding. Like to me, like she's up there too, you know, like, so it's hard. Mastriani though does impact, you know, they all impact their team differently. So not to take anything away from her, but if I'm sure North and Western is like, you know,
100%. Not taking anything away from her, but just like trying to make room for Gilbert in some way. That's, you know, certainly what I would be thinking. Okay. Last one, who I feel like is like a sneaky
dark
threat.
Horse. I do too.
I like, but like very legitimate potential. I think if Maryland wins, 100% going accordingly.
I mean, if Maryland wins, it would be very interesting because if you're thinking about transfer success on teams, we talk a lot about UNC's transfers. You've got Aldave, you've got Dirk, you've got Geiersbach, but look at Maryland. You've got Cordingley, you've got Abby Bosco, two of the best players in the country. While the UNC transfers are all really good, the impact and the way that Cordingley went into the Terp offensive scheme and just fit right in and completed it fully. I mean, they are young. They were such a young offense last year. And to be able to come in so seamlessly and score 83 points this season with a new team, obviously she knew them from playing in the Big Ten, so she had familiarity. But if they win the national championship, that will make that voting so hard because you have legacy players like Ortega and North in that mix. And you give it to them as sort of a hat tip to their career because they're both so incredible and have both done so much for the sport. Or is it like Cordingley is the reason, one of the main reasons that Maryland's back on top? Like that will make, I think, Maryland winning the national championship, I think makes this race the most like unclear to me.
100%. Yeah. I mean, I think that was probably dramatic for me to say that that she will win regardless because now I'm backtracking. but yeah, it'll be interesting because technically you are looking at just 2022. And if Maryland were to win the national championship and you look at, you know, what the Twarton to me stands for is like the biggest like factor in your team's success. And to me, that's Cordingley. There have been just a few games where she's been held to few points and otherwise she has had big, like there's no game that James, like she scores less than 4 points. And the way she does it too, to me, you know, I just love the way she plays because she's facilitating, she's scoring goals. She's a clear, like the perfect dual threat where, you know, and so, you know, I'm going, all these players are so good because I'm like, oh, Ortega's that way too. And, you know,
yeah, I know
they're all so good. That's why they're finalists.
Exactly. I think so. My one complaint, about it, and I don't know how to fix it, is the lack of position diversity in these finalists.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's like points, like it's just defensively, you're not going to have the stats to back up your impact. And it's hard because it's a team, you know, team defense. So, but there's so many attackers on this list. And Meg Taylor did it a few years ago. And like it was awesome when a goalie won, but it's challenging. Like you've got there are some great defenders in this country. You know, Emma Trenchard, Megan Ball, Abby Bosco, to name a few. Like it just sort of stinks. Like Lizzie Colson was in the final five last year, and I was obviously so jazzed about that. But like there's no way, like you can't say that there's no defenders like that are in the top five of the country. Now, that being said, who do you take off this list? I mean, we already have like three more attackers right. We want to put in here. So, but it is a challenge, right. I think, the way the award shifted so that it's an attacker's award, essentially, it feels like.
I think it'll be interesting next year. I think it's going to be wide open because I think a lot of, you know, we talk about the COVID grad year. Every year that phases out, it's like, think about how much better all of these attackers are getting every single year. And it's like, as a defender, there's only so much you can do about that with the shot clock, with the way that the game is called. It's like you can prep more and more to like, you know, figure out the puzzle of like how to get an extra free position, how to, you know, crack the code of a zone or whatever. I think the game is tilted in favor of offense regardless. And so I think with an extra year of eligibility, you're able to, you know, figure that out even a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, the rule changes certainly, like shot clock being the biggest. I mean, my final four senior year, our semifinal game was 5-3 and our championship, our championship was 8-7 and that included an overtime. So
that was a barn burner.
A barn burner. So, like they were defensive battles, right? And now it's like, you know, teams are averaging 16, 17 goals a game, averaging. So,
yeah,
it's just really hard defensively when you look at the production on the offensive side to say, oh, they held them to you know, holding somebody under 10 goals is now an accomplishment, where before that was the expectation. So right. Maybe it'll just take a few more years of things, sort of like a new normal expectation for D. But yeah, you're right. I mean, every year the rules feel like they're more offensively minded. The stick technology gets better. These women are shooting faster. The skill level goes up. So yeah, it's going to be a hard shift, but I hope that it happens.
It'll be interesting.
All the defenders out there working hard.
Yeah. Yeah. I think I do think once grad years start to phase out, it will become a little bit more neutralized, and I'm sure there'll be some more rule changes as we go, as there are every couple of years, to, you know, make it more fair, I guess. Like,
yeah,
we'll see. Should be interesting. We'll have to have another podcast about rules.
Oh yes, we could have some guests for that.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for hopping on. It was a great 35 minutes of chatting lax, and can't wait to see who wins it all.
Yes, can't wait. Either way, a big win for the sport, regardless. These athletes have given us an incredible experience this year. So
for sure. Before we sign off, tell us what's going on Unleashed.
Unleashed overnight, Charlotte North, Lizzie Colson in November, Chula Vista Academy, premierlacrossing.com/academy. That's how you can find it. Unleash overnight. I'm going, trying to go as a camper because I want to learn from both of those. But we're filling up. So if you're interested, shoot me a DM or go on our website and look. But I'm so, so excited about that, to have both of those women coaching. Next gen of players.
Awesome. That's so awesome. Sign up. All right. Well, we'll talk soon.
All right.
Bye. Bye.
IL Women Podcast, the source of her sport.